Welcome to the Raging Rhino Podcast. This is podcast 200. My name is John. Comic books are for children. I've heard that all my life. I still see it on social media today, usually from people who are against comic book movies that are geared toward more mature audiences. Especially the Snyderverse. Of course, comic books can be for children, but they don't have to be, and in reality, have often been geared more towards teenagers and adults, even in the early years of the medium. Once you look into the history of how it got pigeonholed into being for children, you begin to understand how an entire industry was manipulated. Now, if you know anything about me from my podcasts on comic books or my appearances on the Blatcast, you know I am a DC Comics fan. So as I go through the history in this and the next episode, it's a two-parter, I'm going to focus on DC. But the ramifications were felt across the comic book industry. First off, my experience. I've stated before on this podcast that my first exposure to superheroes was the Challenge of the Super Friends cartoon in the fall of 1978. I was 6 years old, and like most kids of that era, I can remember waking up early on Saturday mornings so I could be in front of the TV eating heavily sugared cereal while the opening theme played. A few months later, not long after my 7th birthday, I was wandering around the Handy Andy grocery store in San Antonio, Texas, while my mom shopped. I walked down the magazine aisle, and I saw in big, dynamic letters, Flash! Whoa, it was that guy from the cartoon on the cover, and he was dancing with Batgirl at a party with his archenemy Captain Cold in the background. A guy in a gas mask was shooting Bizarro in the foreground. A mysterious hand held a party invitation that promised a death, but the victim's name was conveniently covered by the thumb. It was only 40 cents, so I brought it to my mother, and she got it for me. Oh, little did she know. Now keep in mind, I am 7 years old at this time, opening my very first comic book bought by my mother because she, like most other adults, knew that comic books are for kids. The issue opens with Flash running through Central City against his will. Someone has mentally taken over his motor skills, and he's running to them even while his mind is frantically trying to figure out how to escape. He ends up in a motel room with a teenage girl who is obsessed with the Flash. She admires his body, and it's heavily implied that she wants to have sex with him, and with her powers, she can force him to do so. She forces him to take off his mask, and she's disappointed because he's too ordinary. The girl leaves and a befuddled Barry Allen remains in the room. Unfortunately, Barry's wife, Iris, has been suspicious and secretly tracked him. Sees the girl leaving the room where she knows her husband is and storms in, accusing him of adultery. She drives off recklessly, and Flash saves her from a fatal crash. And in classic 70s fashion, they quickly talk it out and resolve the issue. Now, folks, this is just the first couple of pages. They get ready for the policeman's costume ball. Barry is a police scientist, after all. They were supposed to go as Batman and Batgirl, but the costume shop messed up. So, of course, Barry decides to go as the Flash. Once there, the guy in the gas mask, who I will learn later is dressed as the Earth 2 Sandman, is going around shooting people with his gun. What he's actually doing is dosing some of them with angel dust, which I will learn later on is a 70s term for PCP. The Flash is shot a dose of the drug and is struggling to overcome the effects. Meanwhile, a violent escaped prisoner, Clive Yorkin, hell of a name, who had been given enhanced strength and energy absorption powers through illegal experimentation by a prison doctor, has stowed away in the trunk of Barry's car and is stalking the party. Flash hears Iris scream, staggers towards it, and finds Yorkin standing over her body. Yorkin flees, but Barry collapses next to Iris. The issue ends with a police officer dressed as Batman saying that one of them needs an ambulance, but the other is already dead. The next issue reveals Iris has been murdered, supposedly by Yorkin, but it's not. So, at 7 years old, my first comic book issue dealt with mental coercion and assault, attempted rape, adultery accusations, illegal drug use, and murder. Please do not tell me comic books are for children. But that's just one kid's introduction to the medium, and I'm coming in much later in the overall narrative. Okay. If you go back to the golden age of comic book superheroes, which really got going in 1938 with the debut of Superman in Action Comics number 1, you'll see that even though it was intended to be for a younger audience, they were still pretty mature stories. In the dozen pages that constitute Superman's first appearance, he deals with a falsely accused man minutes away from the death penalty, an abusive husband, saving Lois, who had been abducted by a guy she refused to dance with, and a corrupt United States senator. Batman's first appearance in Detective Comics 27 has a stabbing death, a shooting death, an attempted gas poisoning, and Batman himself remorselessly punching a guy into a vat of chemicals that instantly kills him, calling it a fitting end for his kind. Not quite children material, is it? Really more for teenagers and older. I mean, if you really want to reach, you could say children back then were expected to mature much faster, so maybe the publishers thought the kids could handle it if they got a hold of it. I mean, these days, parents think children have to be protected from Lego Darkseid. Seriously, that's an actual conversation I overheard in Costco. So, why do people erroneously consider comic books to be exclusively for children? Well, something happened between that original golden age era of superheroes and the late 70s when I started reading. The golden age ended in 1956 with the debut of the guy I was just talking about, Barry Allen's Flash, in Showcase number 4. But 2 years before that, something happened that forced a change of tone in comic books. Frederick Wertham was a German-American psychiatrist whose book, Seduction of the Innocent, argued that comic books were a major contributing cause of juvenile delinquency, violence, sexual deviance, and a host of other social problems. His book became enormously influential. It helped fuel a public panic, Senate hearings on the comic book industry, and the eventual creation of the Comics Code Authority that reshaped the entire medium for decades. The book, published on April 19, 1954, arrived at a moment of already heightened post-war anxiety about juvenile delinquency and quickly amplified existing concerns about mass media's influence on children. The book became a minor bestseller. It was widely reviewed and excerpts featured in popular magazines and helped crystallize a full-blown moral panic around comic books. Just 2 days after its release, that panic moved into the halls of government. The U.S. Senate Judiciary Committee's subcommittee to investigate juvenile delinquency, say that five times fast, opened televised hearings on comic books in New York on April 21st and 22nd, 1954, with a follow-up session on June 4th. Wortham was the star witness. He testified that comic books were an important contributing factor in many cases of juvenile delinquency, compared the industry to Hitler, saying Hitler was a beginner compared to the comic book industry, and repeated his claims that crime, horror, and superhero titles were harming America's youth. Other witnesses included publishers, most notably EC Comics' William Gaines, whose defense of a severed head cover became infamous, along with psychologists and industry representatives. The hearings generated front-page newspaper coverage and intensified public pressure. The subcommittee's final report, issued in 1955 as Senate Report Number 84-62, stopped short of declaring comics the sole cause of delinquency. How nice of them. It acknowledged multiple factors, but concluded that the nation could not afford the calculated risk of continuing to mass disseminate crime and horror comic books to children. And it urged the industry to clean up its content voluntarily. No federal ban or direct government censorship law resulted from the hearings, but the combination of the book's publicity and the televised proceedings created a climate in which legislation at the state and local level proliferated. Within about a year, more than a dozen states passed laws restricting comic book sales, and some cities banned certain titles outright. Public comic book burnings took place in various communities. A Gallup poll taken in late 1954 found that roughly 70% of Americans believed comic books contributed to juvenile crime. Conveniently for Wortham, in the summer of 1954, four teenage boys in Brooklyn, led by 18-year-old Jack Coslow, committed a series of brutal, seemingly motiveless attacks on homeless men that left at least one dead. The press dubbed them the Brooklyn Thrill Killers, and the case became a national sensation at the height of the anti-comics panic. Frederick Wortham was appointed by the court as the psychiatric expert in the case. He examined Coslow and concluded that comic books were a key causal factor in the crimes. Wortham specifically highlighted a fetish series called Knights of Horror, as it turns out, illustrated by Superman co-creator Joe Shuster. When he showed Coslow copies of the books, Coslow acknowledged reading material of that type. Wortham then publicly, and in testimony, linked the boys' violence and sadism directly to such reading, arguing that the comics have provided both the ideas and the emotional stimulus for the attacks. Although no clear evidence established that the boys had actually purchased or read Nights of Horror itself, Wortham's involvement and conclusions were widely reported. The case was repeatedly cited by anti-comics advocates, including Wortham himself, as real-world proof of the dangers that he had described in Seduction of the Innocent. It intensified the public and legislative backlash against crime in horror comics, contributed to local and state bans on Nights of Horror, and helped keep the broader comics controversy in the headlines through late 1954 and on into 55. Like every other societal panic, people reacted instead of scrutinizing the claims and analyzing the facts. Wortham claimed his conclusions for Seduction of the Innocent rested on roughly 7 years of clinical work with children, both delinquent and non-delinquent, primarily at the Lafarge Clinic, a low-cost mental health clinic he co-founded in Harlem, along with cases from other New York hospitals. He said he and his colleagues had examined many thousands of young people, and that comics were definitely and completely harmful. He also analyzed the content of the comics themselves. Violence, sexual imagery, advertisements for weapons, while also drawing on some secondhand reports. But the documented research had serious limitations that later review has made clear. The sample was heavily skewed toward troubled adolescents who already showed behavior problems, delinquency, or psychiatric issues. A large share of the youth under 16 at his Lafarge Clinic had diagnoses of behavior disorders. This was not a representative group of typical comic book readers. The methodology was clinical and anecdotal rather than controlled scientific research. There were no clear statistical summaries, no properly described control groups of non-delinquent readers, no transparent interviewing protocols, and the book itself contained almost no citations or bibliography. Wortham also exaggerated the scale of his direct client contact. Archival counts show roughly 500 under 17 admissions at the Harlem Clinic over about a decade, not the many thousands he touted. In 2012, University of Illinois professor Carol L. Tilley examined Wortham's original case notes and papers after they became available at the Library of Congress. The research had been sealed until 2010 at the request of Wortham's estate, which in and of itself is common, especially when it involves sensitive medical information. However, it is my opinion that Wortham and his estate knew that the research was seriously flawed, because the only people granted special permission to see the research prior to 2010 were supporters of Wortham's work. Professor Tilley documented that he systematically manipulated, overstated, compromised, and fabricated evidence, especially material presented as coming from his clinical interviews. He combined statements from multiple children into single composite cases. He altered ages, omitted key contextual details such as prior abuse, family dysfunction, other preferred reading material, low intelligence, gang involvement, or sexual history, and rephrased quotes to strengthen the anti-comics thesis. He attributed colleagues' observations or secondhand stories as if they were his own direct findings. And he inflated the number of cases while presenting selective or invented details. The book's evidence was heavily distorted to suit the rhetoric. Wortham treated most comics as a single harmful category. He argued they taught techniques of crime and violence and glamorized criminals, even when the stories ended with punishment. He claimed they stimulated sexual arousal, sadism, and abnormal sexual ideas in children. He said they promoted illiteracy, cruelty, deceit, and disrespect for authority. He insisted they harmed both normal and already troubled children, and that the primary victims were the normal kids. He rejected industry claims of educational or harmless content and viewed even the good superhero titles as part of the problem. He focused particular criticism on DC's flagship heroes, the Trinity, calling Superman, Batman, and Wonder Woman books a special form of crime comics. Wortham infamously portrayed Batman and Robin's relationship as a wish dream of two homosexuals living together. He described their secret identity life as homoerotic. He claimed it fostered homoerotic tendencies and an adolescent with adult love relationship in young readers. And he linked this to cases of boys involved in same-sex activity who read Batman. The research basis was primarily his clinical interviews plus his interpretation of individual panels. Professor Tilley's archival work revealed major problems. A frequently cited 13-year-old in his book, described as a special devotee of Batman, who had sexually assaulted another boy, actually preferred Superman, crime, and war comics. And the boy had himself been previously sexually assaulted. Details Wortham omitted. Statements about Batman and Robin's closeness actually came from two older teens, aged 16 and 17, who were already in a long-term same-sex relationship and who preferred other heroes such as Tarzan or the Submariner for their erotic fantasies. Quotes were combined and recontextualized. On Wonder Woman, Wortham called her the lesbian counterpart of Batman, a cruel, phallic woman, and an undesirable ideal for girls. He said she was anti-masculine, emphasizing power and independence over traditional nurturing roles. And he linked her stories to sadism, bondage, and lesbian overtones. He claimed she was frightening for boys and a morbid ideal for girls. Now, granted, Wonder Woman comes from a society solely of women, so lesbian innuendos should be pretty obvious, but it wasn't until George Perez that became overt. And additionally, bondage elements were real and had been acknowledged by creator William Moulton Marston. And if you know anything about him, his alternate lifestyle influenced his stories. Regardless, Wortham's research basis was content analysis of the comics and clinical observations of girls reading. Archival checks, again, showed selective use of cases and omission of the broader life circumstances of the children cited. On Superman, Wortham linked him to Nietzschean ideas, violent race superiority and fascist or force-based values. He said the character undermined the dignity of ordinary people, promoted ruthless physical power, and that the costume evoked Nazi Schutzstaffel imagery. He viewed Superman stories as contributing to delinquency and authoritarian attitudes. Again, the basis was content interpretation and the same clinical anecdotes used elsewhere. The claims had no rigorous comparative data to support a causative link. In short, Wortham's specific claims about DC characters rested on selective, often altered clinical anecdotes from a non-representative sample of troubled youth, combined with his interpretive readings of comic panels and stories. Modern examination of his papers has shown systematic distortion of that clinical material. The book contains almost no transparent documentation that would allow independent verification of the cases as originally presented. And yes, there were people at the time who opposed Wortham's findings in their testimony, but the voices of those offering a more realistic point of view of comic books were drowned out by the hysteria. The broader societal consequences were profound. The panic reinforced the myth that comics were primarily children's entertainment and therefore required adult supervision and moral policing. This stigma lingered for decades, even when the medium later matured. Sales overall declined dramatically. Dozens of publishers went out of business. Entire genres, especially crime and horror comics, were nearly wiped out. Hundreds of writers, artists, and other creators left the field. The commercial and cultural damage was severe and long-lasting, reshaping the entire landscape of American comics for a generation. Facing the threat of government intervention, distributors refusing certain titles, and collapsing public goodwill, the comic book publishers formed the Comics Magazine Association of America in September 1954. In October, they established the Comics Code Authority, a self-regulatory body with a detailed code of standards. Comics that complied received a seal of approval on the cover. Distributors and retailers largely refused to carry comic books without it, giving the code near mandatory force in practice. The Comics Code Authority fundamentally reshaped the tone of mainstream American comics from the mid-50s onward. And that will be in the next episode. For now, this is the Raging Rhino Podcast. You'll hear from me again.